And as I fade the theremin down, this is Terry Frost, and welcome to Martian Drive-In Podcast number 70. This time around, I'm doing a classic and a recent film, both of which are made most interesting by charismatic actors being in them. The first one is the classic science fiction horror film from 1958, The Blob, starring Steve McQueen. And then we go to 2013 for a movie that has two charismatic actors in it at minimum, and that is Only Lovers Left Alive, starring Tom Hiddleston and the wonderful and endlessly charismatic Tilda Swinton. So we go from blobs to vampires this time around. So sit back, relax, I will get the contact details out of the way, and the show can get started. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hey, how's everybody going? It's getting sunny here. I'm looking out the window, and there is not a cloud in the sky, which is always a good thing. So thank you. Welcome to the show. I did mess around with some software on my phone. A piece of software which is very un-me, and it's called AutoWrap, and I put in a bit of audio about this podcast into a rap music generator. And now there's only a short file, so you don't worry too much. You're not going to have to listen to my voice as an auto-tuned rap for very long, but I just thought I'd have a go at it, and I'll play it for you now and get that out of the way.
Welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast number 70. My name is Terry Frost, and this time I'm doing The Blob from 1958 and Only Lovers Left Alive from 2013. Enjoy.
Yeah, blame the software, don't blame me. So that's what I'm doing this time, The Blob and Only Lovers Left Alive. Jim Jarmusch film and a Steve McQueen film, but not a Stephen McQueen film, both of which I picked up recently. The Blob and the Beware the Blob, the sequel to The Blob, I picked up from Umbrella Entertainment, who had a $5 DVD sale online. So I went with that, and I enjoyed the first one, but not the second one, so that's why I'm only talking about the first one. And Only Lovers Left Alive, there was a sale on at JB Hi-Fi, which I went with, and the interesting thing about that is I went there, bought the disc along with a couple of others. I think I got Seven, the David Fincher movie, and something else anyway. And so I get the disc home, and I go, okay, well, I want to do this for the podcast, so I want to watch it. I open the blue disc cover, and there's no disc in it. It's a sealed packet, but by some mysterious commercial magic, there is no Blu-ray disc of Only Lovers Left Alive sitting in that little cover. So I had to troll out to JB Hi-Fi again, and I explained the situation to them. They were very nice, and they replaced it for me with no questions asked. I could have been a scammer, but most scammers are a lot younger and a lot more needy looking than I am, so I got away with it, even though I was totally innocent, of course. So there's that story as far as Only Lovers Left Alive is concerned. But as usual, please support the Patreon campaign. Go to patreon.com/paleocinema, and you too will get to pick a movie for the podcast, and also you get a credit in the style of a movie credit at the end of the podcast in perpetuity. As usual, I'm going to let you know now what I have been watching lately. Okay, there haven't been a hell of a lot of movies that I've watched. It's been a busy week for various reasons, but I've got a few here. I've got a Western recommendation for you that's kind of cool, and it's from about 1963. It's a Western called The Last Sunset, which stars Rock Hudson, Kirk Douglas, and Dorothy Malone. And it's by directed by Robert Aldrich, who I did a Paleo Cinema podcast about a number of films by Robert Aldrich. He's the guy who directed movies like Apache and The Big Knife and The Killing of Sister George. Really interesting director. And this Western is kind of a Greek tragedy in a weird way. It's almost like a Greek tragedy, and a number of people have said that online, so I'm pinching the line. It's set before, after, and during a cattle drive to bring some cattle from Mexico into America. The cattle ranch is played by Joseph Cotten in a kind of wasted role, but it's good to see Joseph Cotten playing slightly different kind of character in this one. And the story is that a kind of black-hearted guy played by Kirk Douglas, and in fact he does wear black all through the film, so that's the way you tell he's a bad guy, turns up at the ranch, and they're looking for a ranch hand, so he agrees to help them bring the herd up into America. He's had a previous relationship with Joseph Cotton's wife, played by Dorothy Malone, and she has a teenage daughter, played by Carol Linley, who takes an interest in the Kirk Douglas character. Then along comes a sheriff from up north who's out to bring back and arrest the Kirk Douglas character, played by Rock Hudson, and it's a kind of a good Rock Hudson role. He really is okay in this film. And there are kind of different dynamics there. There's the relationship between Dorothy Malone's character and Kirk Douglas, and then she also takes a shine to the Rock Hudson character. So basically what you end up with is kind of like a love quadrangle or a love square between the two females and the two males. It's well directed and it's well made. You can actually see the whole movie on YouTube as well. So if you want to see The Last Sunset, it is available on YouTube. You can throw it up onto a screen from there. And it's also got a weird subplot. I'm not going to actually tell you what the subplot is, but it's very important to the end of the film, and it makes the film a little bit weird and transgressive. But I kind of liked it. I thought I'd give it a go because it popped up on my radar. And it's a good, solid Western with a kind of sick twist to the tale. And the interesting thing, too, is there are a whole bunch of different acting styles at play in this one, and they all clash with each other. So from that point of view, it's car crash movie watching. Kirk Douglas is over the top. Joseph Cotten and Dorothy Malone are very good in it. Rock Hudson does a pretty good solid role, but they're all playing totally differently to each other. So I watched that and enjoyed it. I did, as I said, saw Beware the Blob, also known as Son of the Blob, which was a 1970 sequel to The Blob, directed by none other than Larry Hagman from I Dream of Jeannie, who does have a very small role with no dialogue in the film. It's got a fairly interesting cast. Robert Walker Jr. plays a protagonist in it. It's got a whole bunch of improv comedians from the 1970s, like Del Close and people like that, in there as well. Godfrey Cambridge is in there with Marlene Clark, and they have a good chunk at the start of the film. And it feels very much like a lot of the film was improvised around the plot of Godfrey Cambridge working on an oil pipeline in Alaska, picking up a piece of the blob, bringing it home, accidentally thawing it out and letting it loose. And, it's a weird little film, and it does seem like most of the people involved in it were drug-fucked at the time. But as a completist, of course, you want to see all iterations of a particular franchise, and Beware the Blob is a part of that. The other two more things I've seen, which kind of took me a while for fairly obvious reasons. I'd never actually seen the 1963 Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, Rex Harrison, Cleopatra before. But I had the disc. I picked up the disc for like $10 on two Blu-rays. The movie is so long, it takes two Blu-rays to watch it. And I watched it, and the scale of it and the epic framing of the film and the sets that were made in Cinecittà Studios in Rome are incredible. The set pieces of Cleopatra entering Rome and a few other bits and pieces are mind-boggling. There are so many people in the crowd. The sets are so enormous. The grandeur and the scale of it is mind-blowing. But in the end, it's not that good a film. It takes too long to say what it's got to say. It does have some very fine acting in it. Burton is fantastically good in it. Roddy McDowall is mind-blowingly good in it. There are a whole bunch of English character actors supporting everybody who are really good. And even Rex Harrison as Caesar is pretty good as well. Elizabeth Taylor, It's not a fantastic role for Elizabeth Taylor. I think she's been better in other things. But, of course, she almost died before the making of the film and had pneumonia and had to have a tracheotomy. So if she wasn't at her best, there are any number of reasons why. The chemistry between her and Burton, of course, is very, very apparent in the film. But nonetheless, it was one of those movies that was no more for the making of it than for the film itself. It was an amazingly big media event at the time with the Elizabeth Taylor-Richard Burton relationship starting, and that was probably the biggest celebrity news story of 1963. It really overwhelmed everything else possible. And it does show that these kind of historical epics were amazing pieces of filmmaking. It just is mind-blowing to look at. Beautiful, beautifully shot by several different directors, but I may well dedicate a podcast to it at some time in the future, but it's just a very long, very big film with not too much right at the heart of it. But I was in the mood to watch another Richard Burton film, so I went through the archive and found Where Eagles Dare with Richard Burton, Mary Ewer, Clint Eastwood, and again, a whole bunch of supporting English character actors, some of the same ones who were in Cleopatra, in fact. It's about a kind of team of experts who have to raid a German chateau on top of a mountain, well, castle, really, and get back somebody who's been kidnapped there. It's got a script by Alastair MacLean, and Alastair MacLean wrote a novelization of it as well. There's lots of running around, jumping, Richard Burton trying to be an action guy, even though he was basically an alcoholic and not in great shape at the time. Clint Eastwood being Clint Eastwood. In fact, this is the movie, it's said by IMDb, where Clint Eastwood kills more people than in any other film he ever made, mostly because there's a long sequence of the film where Clint Eastwood is planting explosives throughout the castle and then machine gunning people and throwing back grenades they're throwing at him and doing all that kind of action-y stuff. In a very over-the-top kind of way. It's very much a blokey kind of adventure. It does have two female actors in it, Mary Ewer and Ingrid Pitt from Vampire Lovers, playing kind of supporting agents to the main thrust of the action. But it's for 1968, it feels very much like a 1958 movie in some ways, mostly because of the fact that it's a World War II adventure. Some great stunt work, by the way. The stunt work and some of the aerial photography is very good, and I'll give it that. The second unit work was done by Yakima Canutt, who was a world-famous stuntman, and in fact did the chariot race from Ben-Hur, amongst other things. So Yakima Canutt did all the second unit for this film. And it's a good, solid action film. It's no better than it needs to be. Burton has some fun mind-fucking some Nazis. Not fucking them, but mind-fucking them in one good sequence in the film. But it's pretty much just an actioner. It's kind of along the levels of other Alastair MacLean adaptations like Ice Station Zebra and things like that. But I sat back and, after working my way through Cleopatra, decided to work my way through Where Eagles Dare, and it was a much easier experience. But anyway, that's about it for what I've been watching lately. What I'm going to do now is take a break. And when we get back, we're going to do this chronologically, of course. I'm going to take a look at the first big starring role for Steve McQueen, being the Blob from 1958. And you know the music I'm going to play right now.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door, all around the wall, a splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. The blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps.
That's your earworm for the day. If you go onto YouTube, and I posted this on Facebook, if you go onto YouTube, there's a 10-hour version of that song on YouTube. I didn't listen to it all, but I did post it. So if you have 10 hours to kill and you have an interest in basically brainwashing, then please listen to all 10 hours of Beware of the Blob, written by Burt Bacharach and Mac David, not Hal David. It's Mac David, his brother. And sung by a guy called Bernie Nee. There was a lot of overdubbing, so it sounded like you had the four preps or something doing it, but it was actually one guy called Bernie Nee. It does say the five blobs in the blurb, but it was just one guy doing the singing. So, on to the movie. It was made in 1957, released in 1958. The odd thing about it, there are a number of odd things about it, but one of the odd things about it is Steve McQueen was 27 when he made this movie, in which he plays a teenager. This is not in any way a world record. There have been any number of actors who've played much younger than their age, and Steve McQueen kind of does okay, except in the fact that he's got a well-used face in playing a teenager. Unlike a lot of horror movies of its time, it wasn't made in Hollywood. It was actually made in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. And the director of the film, Irvin S. Yeworth Jr., was actually the local minister. So this movie definitely doesn't come from anywhere near the Hollywood mainstream. Steve McQueen had been an actor in New York for a while. He'd done some TV roles. He got $3,000 for this movie. He was offered 10% of the net profits, and he would have made a lot more money had he taken it, but he didn't think the movie was going to be successful. So he took the $3,000 and run. Now, the good best thing for him, as far as the movie is concerned, is that the people who were looking to make a Western for television, wanted dead or alive, saw Steve McQueen in this movie and hired him to play Josh Randall in the TV series Wanted Dead or Alive, which then led on to other things like The Magnificent Seven, which then led on to Sand Pebbles and Bullet and The Thomas Crown Affair and all those other movies that we know Steve McQueen for. The budget on the film was minuscule, $120,000. It does say $240,000 in some places, but the best information I've got is that it was $120,000. Now, as far as the story is concerned, it's bog standard, but really interesting 1950s drive-in fare. It starts with a couple kissing, and they are actually Steve McQueen and Annetta Corsault. Playing Steve Andrews and Jane Martin. They're having a clinch on a Saturday night in summer. She pulls away because she's virginal and it's the 1950s and he couldn't shag her. And then they see a shooting star which crashes nearby, so they go and investigate it and see an old man played by a character actor who'd been working since Silent Days called Olin Howland, who's found something around pitted little meteorite in the crater called dug out by the impact and has got some goop from it on his hand and it starts devouring him. They take him to see the local doctor and leave him there, and of course things roll on naturally from there. The blob has a voracious appetite and starts eating the town surreptitiously. Nighttime being a good time to do this because people aren't missed for a long time. It's the weekend, so people might have gone away. So it takes a while for anybody to A, believe Steve and Jane, and B, start doing anything about it. And when they do, They try a number of things to stop it, electricity, and the doctor tries to pour acid on it. No, actually, it's his nurse that does that. And the blob then escapes and starts devouring various people, a guy in a garage, a number of other people as well, until eventually, of course, the town becomes aware of it when it attacks a cinema. Now, for the limited budget, this movie's special effects are pretty good. There is a little bit of audacity to a couple of them. There's a scene where Steve and Jane and her annoying brother, played by a kid actor who never worked again, mostly because he wasn't a very good actor, get caught in a diner with the people running the diner, and the blob basically surrounds the diner. This is done by having a picture of the diner there and just chucking a piece of the blob against it. It's audacious as far as special effects concerned. It's only about a 1 second shot, but it shows that the kind of economy of budget leads to, you know, doing these improvisations of necessity. And that's kind of cool too, because that low budget aesthetic works in favor of the film. It's a drive-in movie. It's not meant to be cutting edge special effects stuff. It's meant to be an entertainment. It's meant to be a bit of fun. And if your special effects are a little bit ropey, as long as you don't linger on them, you can get away with a hell of a lot. The blob itself was made out of red food dye and silicone kind of jelly stuff. Apparently, and I don't have a confirmation of this, apparently the original chunk of the blob is sitting in a bucket somewhere and it's still kind of malleable. It hasn't dried out at all, which is a little bit of a worry. But the movie works for a number of reasons. A, Steve McQueen has star power. Even early in his career, at a time when, you know, his skills hadn't developed the way they did when he did Wanted Dead or Alive and had to do episodic television for a couple of seasons. And of course, that's a great way of learning your craft as an actor. He still kind of shines. Nobody's looking at anybody else when Steve McQueen is on the screen and talking. And that's just goes to show that just through luck and looks and a quality of mind, the camera loves certain people, and you really are drawn to them when you see them on film. And then, of course, so it went on to do television and things like that, so nobody else was the breakthrough star of this film, apart, of course, from The Blob, which has now been in one sequel, a remake, and a pending remake for 2016, which I believe has Samuel L. Jackson attached to it. I've seen the movie any number of times. I think I even saw it in the cinema once back in the day. But, well, not when it first was released anyway. I was only a year old. But I was trying to watch it this time with an eye to why it works and why it's become one of the iconic drive-in style horror movies of the 1950s. And there are a few things. I mean, having the title sequence with that music that we played before, Beware of the Blob, and those concentric writhing rings coming out the screen, it really works. I mean, the music's cool and groovy. It shows that you're not to take the movie too seriously as well. Having that kind of funky title song sets the audience in a mood for just sitting back enjoying it, not analysing it too much, which of course I am now doing, and just going with the flow. It prepositions the audience where the filmmakers want them to be, and that's really cool. I like that. Whether it's deliberate choice or not, and deliberate marketing, or whether it's a lightning in the bottle moment of inspiration, it really does set the movie up well. And then you have the kissing, and they get straight into the plot. There's the kissing, there's the establishing of the two protagonists, there's the shooting star blasting across the sky and then flaring in the horizon as it hits. And there's no messing around, there's no establishing where the town is or what it is. We only ever see the town at night time because, of course, the whole movie takes place in one night. We never actually see the town in daylight in the whole film. You also very early get established one of the things that's going to get into driving the audience on board as well. And that is the fact that the cops are out to stop teenagers having good fun. Not all of them. There is Dave, one of the cops, who's kind of sympathetic to them. And as long as they don't go breaking any laws, he'll cut them some slack. And then there's another more serious cop who was a bit of a war hero. That's Sergeant Burt, played by John Benson. He's a lot more of a hard ass and not willing to give them a go. So you get Steve and Jane going, finding the old man. The old man's got the blob on him. They take it to the doctor, leave him there, and things escalate from there. And you write in the plot. There's no fucking around at the start. You write where you need to be. You want to see it unwind. People start getting absorbed by the blob. And a lot of that is, well, all but a tiny bit of it is shown off screen. But you know what's happening and why. And it's just beautifully set up. Now, one of the other virtues of this film, which took it out of the ordinary, was they did it widescreen and they did it in colour. Even though there was a limited budget, and a lot of the budget must have gone on the processing of the film, they decided not to make it black and white like a lot of Roger Corman films of the late 50s, for instance. They went with colour straight away, and it's a nice saturated-looking colour as well. It's not one of those kind of weird film processes where you go on the cheap and then 5 years after the print struck, all of the blue colours disappear from the print. And there were colour processes where that was the case. There are any number of movies that really are in a bad way because the people chose badly on the kind of colour process that they chose to do. Jacques Tati's Jour de Fête is a movie that went with a cheap colour process, and so people mostly see the black and white one for that reason, even though the colour one was redone fairly recently. It's one of those things where they got lucky in a number of ways with this movie. They got lucky by having the theme song at the start, having the colour thing, having somebody who was a breakout star and who, when the film was re-released in the cinemas 10 years after it was made, was a big star at that time. So you've got a number of little touch points there where the movie just kind of works. The Blob itself is a good villain as well. You don't have to kind of humanize it at all. It's a mindless hunger. It's a you know, something without a mouth but with an endless hunger. And that's all you need to know. The rest of it is you deal with the human side of things. You have no bad guy except for this weird natural life form from outer space just coming in and starts absorbing life and seems to like animal life. It doesn't seem to suck up any trees at all, which is a missed opportunity, but you know, they did have a limited budget on this one. And of course there are hot rodders in the town who end up helping out, trying to get the word out that things are going wrong here. The script is really good too. It's got all of the touch points. It's got establishing the characters, the escalation, the monster, having a big set piece, which in this case is the monster attacking the midnight movie session, which they managed to do quite cheaply by using an actual cinema, and some very ropey special effects at times to put across what needed to be put across. So I don't know whether they storyboarded it, but the script works really well, and it works for the budget, which is another thing that they didn't have to go too ambitious with their special effects or the events of the movie to get across what they were trying to get across. And also you've got the aspect of Cold War paranoia. A seemingly unstoppable force is attacking kind of small town America in a very literal way. And that, of course, plays into the fears that Americans had of communism and of nuclear war and war in general in the 1950s. So it's got that kind of awareness of what worries and scares people at a deep level in the culture in which the movie was made. And for the audience, and for me as an audience member, one of the lovely things about this movie is it's one of those movies that you see when you're young. And yes, it's got the scares for you when you're a kid, particularly if you're a kid that doesn't live in an era of torture porn and all sorts of real life news horrors. It was a quite scary film when I first saw it, and it was very, very effective in that. But it's one of those movies where if you see it as a child, you'll have a love for it forever. And one of the ways in which the film rewards you for that is that when you watch it as an adult, the things you love about it are still valid. You're not aware of the fact that your tastes have changed and you can see all the flaws in it. Yes, you can see the flaws in this film. There is some ropey acting in various bits of the film at times, and some of the dialogue is a little bit cheesy and ropey, but that stuff doesn't overwhelm the kind of forward motion of the film as it plays out. And that's another thing I really like, the fact that it hasn't disappointed over time. You really, if you liked it as a kid, you can watch it now and appreciate it now. and you won't feel ashamed of having liked it as a kid. You have a nostalgia for it that's unsullied by rewatching the film. Whereas there are a number of other films that you might have liked as a kid. Now, one of my touchstones on this is I did like The Valley of Gwangi as a kid, but watching it now, I can see the sexual politics is fucked. And this Ray Harryhausen special effects, however cutting edge they were at the time, now suffer compared to modern stuff. But I really, this movie doesn't do any of that. I don't have fun with this movie, picking the flaws in it. I have fun appreciating its virtues and appreciating what they did on a ridiculously low budget in a town in Pennsylvania, a small town in Pennsylvania, with a crew and actors who are fairly new at the business. And yet, it's a movie that's being remade in 2016 with a budget astronomically higher than the budget of the first film. It really is one of those great classics of science fiction. The fact that I bought it and a sequel for $5 on DVD is a bit of a shame. I think the movie's worth more than that, but I got a good bargain by buying them as I did. But it's one of those movies where you get a really good cheap print of it, and in some very minor level you feel ashamed at how little you paid to get it, because the movie is a classic of cinema. But because it wasn't attached to a large studio, it hasn't got, at least in Australia, an enormous Blu-ray release and a lot of publicity towards it and all of those kind of things. But Universal did a lot of good science fiction and horror films in the 50s. Corman had a lot of fun in the 1950s and 1960s with this genre. But this one's a little bit of an outlier, a little bit of a standalone one. And yet, it's really entertaining and really rewarding to watch this movie. I really like it a lot. And rewatching it was a lot of fun. The sequel, not so much. But watching the original movie was a good time. It was not a waste of time at all, and it was a lot of fun to do. And I recommend that you do that if you haven't lately. So that's about it for that one. When I get back, I'm going to talk about a much more serious film, and nonetheless a lot of fun. Only Lovers Left Alive, the Jim Jarmusch film from a couple of years ago, starring Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston.
My regards to that suicidally romantic scoundrel.
Well, let's hope he's just romantic.
You being so reclusive in everything is probably only going to make people more interested in your music.
Yeah. What a drag. Shouldn't she be sleeping in a coffin somewhere?
I'm really, really hungry.
Could you smell it all the way from LA?
We're gonna have so much fun together.
We gotta go. Right now. Come in.
Is that the really good stuff?
Precisely.
Typo.
My product is secret in your soul.
How can you have lived for so long and still not get it? You've been pretty lucky in love, though, if I may say so.
I have what you need.
Not what I need.
Only Lovers Left Alive is a 2013 vampire movie directed and written by Jim Jarmusch. It stars Tilda Swinton, Tom Hiddleston, Mia Wasikowska, Jeffrey Wright, Anton Yelchin, and John Hurt. It's a vampire movie that never actually uses the V word, which is a little bit of a conceit, but then when you're talking about somebody like Jim Jarmusch, its style is what matters, and this has a lot of the Jim Jarmusch tropes. An outsider's look at America, an emphasis on music, the slow pace and the kind of relaxed plotting. Beautiful visuals. The visuals in this film are stunningly good. And just, you know, that kind of laid back and very, very, and unfortunately very, very non-commercial approach to filmmaking, which has limited his ability to make films to a big extent. Getting funding is a non-trivial task for Jim Jarmusch. In fact, he had to use a German company to get the $7 million he needed to make this film, which is a shame because Jarmusch's films are always a lot of fun. I remember seeing Mystery Train years ago in the cinema, and that was my introduction to his work. And then Ghost Dog and a couple of others. It's really, it's an acquired taste. I'll give Jarmusch that. His movies are an acquired taste, but once you acquire it, it's something you can go back to and enjoy now and then. The story is fairly simple, though, and because it is such a relaxed plotting to the movie. It's pretty simple. A depressed musician reunites with his lover through the romance, which has already endured several centuries, and their romance is interrupted by the arrival of an uncontrollable younger sister. That's the one from IMDb. I'll see if there's a better one sitting around somewhere on Wikipedia, because I want to give it a little more than that. Hang on, there's a good one down the bottom of the IMDb page. Adam, Tom Hiddleston, is an underground musician reunited with his former lover of centuries, Tilda Swinton, after he becomes depressed and tired with the direction human society has taken. Their love is interrupted and tested by her wild and uncontrollable little sister, Ava, played by Mia Wasikowska. The movie starts out really interestingly because Adam and Eve, the two main characters played by Hiddleston and Swinton, are living in different countries. He's living in a great big gothic house in Detroit, which runs on some kind of Nikola Tesla power production system, which is kind of a bit baroque and a little steampunky. His only contact, really, is Ian, played by Anton Yelchin, who supplies him with antique musical instruments. He collects antique musical instruments. And there's a long scene at the start where Ian brings him four guitars, and they're all classic guitars, and Adam has an ability to touch them and understand them. It's there's a little bit of psychic ability in the vampires in this film, and Adam has a wonderful appreciation of musical instruments. He's a musician. His music doesn't get released commercially. He keeps it to himself. He has a vast musical library and a lot of kind of slightly antique equipment. He runs to turntables, and even when he and Eve talk via Skype, he sends her to an old-fashioned cathode ray tube television so he can see her face. So he's kind of slightly out of date and slightly isolated and very much insulated from the world. He calls people zombies, and he thinks that they're killing the planet and that things are bad. It's very hard for him and Eve to get decent blood because people pollute their blood with so many things that it can make them ill. So he has a deal with Dr. Watson, played by Jeffrey Wright, in a very kind of low-key role, to get him some decent A-positive blood, which is the preferred option. Adam asks Ian to get him something. He's contemplating suicide. He's very depressed about the state of the world. And he gets Ian to procure him a hardwood bullet, a bullet with a head that's made out of hardwood, so that he can commit suicide with his .38 revolver if he chooses to. Now, he and Eve have a chat on Skype, or maybe FaceTime, and she decides that she's got to come over and try to pull him out of this funk. They've been lovers for hundreds of years, at least as far back as Shakespearean times, possibly more. But they can't live together. They're living in different cities. He's living in Detroit, in an area that's kind of abandoned in Detroit, and she's living in Tangier in Africa, along with none other than John Hurt's character, Christopher Marlowe. Kit Marlowe lives there as well. And Marlo and Eve are somewhat more engaged with the world. Eve, through Marlo and his assistant, he's being supported by a man called Bilal, whom he's teaching to write. He's a writing student, a middle-aged writing student of Marlo's, and quite a good writer in his own right. And in the conceited universe of this movie, Marlo wrote all of Shakespeare. He looks at a picture of Shakespeare at one stage and calls him an illiterate something or other, for instance. So there's that old chestnut about Christopher Marlo writing Shakespeare's works happens to be true in the universe of Only Lovers Left Alive, which is kind of cool. I mean, we'll let them have this. If you can have vampires, you can definitely have Kit Marlo writing Shakespeare's plays. And through her relationship with Bilal and with Marlo, Eve is much more engaged with the world. She uses an iPhone, for instance, whereas Adam uses some more very Baroque technology in order to communicate with her. And she reads books. She speed reads books in all sorts of languages. This is a great bit before she travels to visit Adam, of course, taking night flights, where she reads a whole bunch of books in a bunch of different languages, speed reading them with her finger running down the, or across the page. And that's kind of cool too. Without, this is a really good bit of showing, not telling. You get the impression that she's incredibly knowledgeable and incredibly engaged with the world and fascinated by human culture in a lot of ways that Adam isn't. He produces his own music but doesn't release it to anybody. He doesn't think it's the zombies, which is what he calls human beings, are good enough to have his music. And that kind of nihilism is what's dragging him down and away from things. He really dislikes the human race, and yet he needs them for various things. Musical instruments and blood being two of the big ones. So Eve visits Adam and he shows her around Detroit at night, and it's beautifully shot. The scenes in Tangier are beautiful as well, but the shots around Detroit with the buildings subtly lit up, large abandoned factories and buildings, the almost empty streets apart from an occasional police car and an occasional other car, are beautifully portrayed in this. And they only get the occasional street light, which from what I understand is what parts of Detroit are like. A dying city isn't something that Americans are used to. And even though there is a kind of artistic renaissance in Detroit, it seems the perfect place for a depressed vampire to live with his instruments. It's got a strong music scene, of course, which is kind of interest to Adam. At one stage, Ian and Ava, the sister played by Mia Wasikowska, take them out to a music gig, which doesn't end well, but nonetheless, Adam takes pride in a way in showing Eve around Detroit. I've actually been to Detroit 5 times. When I was flying around America in 98, Detroit was one of the hubs, and so I actually flew through Detroit with the stop, you know, like change planes at Detroit or just pause at Detroit 5 times on my trips across America. But I never actually visited the place, which is a shame. I only just remembered that. For some reason, I didn't remember it while I was watching the movie, but it was a weird thing. I remember running to catch a plane, a small plane, from Detroit down to Louisville, Kentucky. And I couldn't find my ticket, and they just shoved me on. This is before 9/11. They just shoved me on the plane, and I showed them the ticket as we were taking off almost. But, a big airport there. But, yeah, Detroit is kind of, you know, it's a well-selected place. And, of course, it's a place that Jarmusch likes a lot for the music history of it. In fact, one of the things that Adam takes Eve to is the house where Jack White grew up. They pause outside that so that he can show her that house, and also a really large old theatre, abandoned theatre in Detroit, where they just stand together and look up at this vast theatre come movie palace, which has been left to rot and decay. And it's a striking moment, and it's one of the many beautiful moments in this film as well. The movie, as I said, is very relaxed in pace and takes its own time. I mean, vampires have all the time in the world. Their only limitations, really, are sunrise and sunset. So having protagonists who are vampires really suits the style of movie that Jim Jarmusch makes. And the acting in it is very, very good. Hiddleston's very good as Adam. It was a role originally planned for Michael Fassbender, but he dropped out. Another project came up. Hiddleston is good as Adam. He's kind of nothing like Loki, even though the hairstyle is slightly similar. He's nothing like Loki in the Thor movies or the Avengers. And he does play it very well. And you can see a little bit of Fassbender in the way he plays it too, which is kind of interesting as well. But Tilda Swinton playing Eve, Tilda Swinton with her ageless kind of face and her beautifully luminous eyes is really great in this. And the way she engages with the world of the movie is interesting as well. The way she touches things, the way she looks at things, the way she's delighted by random things is lovely in this film. And John Hurt is really nice as a Marlowe. They give him some sharp and bitchy lines at various times. And like all three of the main protagonists, he brings his kind of back catalogue of genre films with him. All three of them are well known for being in various kinds of genre films. And Mia Wasikowska as well, she's only in it for a fairly short part of the film as Ava, who's living in Los Angeles and comes in ill because she's been kind of supping on polluted blood. And she's a kind of, you know, random predator in a sense, and has no limits. When Adam shares some of his blood supply with her, she wants to gorge herself on it all. She's one of those people with appetites that can't be fulfilled. And even though she... It's almost like, in a different way to Adam, Ava has kind of disengaged with the world by just doing what she likes, by having no limits and by having no kind of self-control. That's the way she engages things. And you can tell that she's not long for the world in some ways because of her randomness and her kind of selfishness in a sense. She doesn't have somebody like Adam has with Eve and Eve has with Adam to, in a really weird and touching sense, humanize themselves. And that's maybe what Jarmusch is trying to say, is that love does humanize people, particularly men. They eventually find out that Ian has been bootlegging Adam's music, which is the reason why random rock kiddies turn up at his house and knock on the door and try to get him to let them in, which he won't do. And as events roll out, they have to leave Detroit. And Eve takes Adam back to Tangier, where the movie comes to a very satisfying ending, a very interesting and a very satisfying ending. It really does. We get to spend a bit more time in Tangier. We get to spend it in some back alleys and some clubs and just see the nightlife of a city which has incredible historic and literary roots. There are any number of artists who, for various reasons in the 20th century particularly, lived in Tangier. William Burroughs was there, for instance. I believe Noel Coward was there for a time. Joe Orton, all sorts of artists. It's a city with a great tradition of expatriates, and Eve becomes one of them, along with the kind of louche Kit Marlowe at her side. And due to circumstances, after they've arrived in Tangier, travel's very exhausting for vampires in the way the world is set up in this. Adam and Eve are running short of blood. They're kind of slowly deteriorating. And they travel through the night streets of Tangier. And Eve has promised Adam a musical instrument because he's had to leave everything behind in Detroit. That life is over. He's moved past everything, but she's promised him an instrument. So she finds him a stringed instrument. And they stand exhausted on in an alley in Tangier, and then they hear some music, and I'm going to play the music for you because it's really interesting stuff. It's non-European music by a Lebanese female singer whose name is Yasmin Hamdan, and she sings a really beautiful song. I'm not going to play all of it for you. I'm going to play you a little bit of it just to give you a feel for the mood for this movie. Then I'm going to also play another track, which is in the movie when Adam and Eve have their reunion. But it just goes to show you the way that Jarmusch, even in a vampire movie, integrates his love of music into the movie. Now, this is a track by Yasmin called Hal. And I hope it gives a little bit of the feel of the movie for you. So we go from that music at one end of the movie to a really incredibly well-chosen track for the reunion of Adam and Eve when they get back together in Detroit. And it's a 1971 R&B track by Denise LaSalle called Trapped by a Thing Called Love, which I'm going to play in its entirety because I like it a lot. And I'm also running a little short on this particular podcast, but this is a track you should definitely track down and have a copy of because it is very groovy. And it's there are some pops and crackles on it, so it's got a vinyl sound, which is always a little bit cool.
Thank you.
Maybe that's something that's missing from a lot of good genre films, and that is a really groovy soundtrack. There are so many genre films that, because of their very nature, don't integrate music into the story as much as maybe they should. Yeah, there are a lot of big blockbusters with explosions, and yes, the second Captain America movie did name-check Marvin Gaye's Trouble Man soundtrack and play a little bit of that, but it's not really something that's done a lot in genre films. And because of the slow and relaxed pace of this one, and because of the beauty of it and the kind of melancholy and the fun of it in a sense, and there are some funny lines in this film, having the music integrated into it so seamlessly is just a beautiful thing. And I think that there are some genre films that do have music integral to them. Guardians of the Galaxy did, for instance. But in general, the music in this film is chosen with such precision and such care and such love that it's an incredibly groovy thing to experience the film. I'm glad I picked up the copy of it. I'm glad I went back and got the disc when the disc was missing from the cover, because I like this film. I don't think it's one of the great films of all time, but I think it's an idiosyncratic and individual work, and it's a different take on vampires, which is a little hard to find these days because there are so many vampire movies that either go at the sparkly, twinkly, eternal boyfriend end of things, and other ones that just go for the blood and the gore. That finding something that's off to one side and kind of an outlier is a kind of groovy thing and a really welcome thing. And I enjoyed the movie a lot for that. It's a kind of, you know, it's a Jarmusch film. And if you either like Jarmusch films or you don't, and I think if you don't, maybe you should watch a couple more and maybe you will. But that's about all I want to say about Only Lovers Left Alive. I liked it. Anyway, I'm going to wind up the podcast now. Thank you again to the Patreon subscribers and to everybody listening. Please watch some good films, enjoy good movies, keep watching the skies, look after yourselves, and I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast, and in a week with a Paleo Cinema. Take care of yourselves. And here are the credits for the Patreon subscribers to the podcast in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine our Scientific Advisor, Julia our Casting Director, Chris our Camera Operator, Christopher our Gaffer, Miss Jane our Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy the Foley Artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, the New York unit director, and Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor. We also have Paul, who does the special makeup effects, and Kathleen, who has yet to have a job in the credits. And Eric, of course, is the set security lead. So thank you to everybody who supports the podcast and to the people who listen to it. If you want to support the podcast with some micropayments, please go to patreon.com/paleocinema, and I'll catch all of you next time.